A reporter once asked the prolific Stephen King if it was true that he wrote every single day of the year except his birthday and the 4th of July. He says that he lied and said yes, but the truth is he even writes on those 2 days. When I heard this, I immediately thought of Mary Troy. As a student in Mary's workshops, I used to be in awe of her dedication. Every morning, she would write between 5 and 7 a.m. I asked her recently if she still does this, even as the director of the MFA program and a professor who teaches multiple classes. She admitted that she now sleeps like a teenager and does not begin writing until 8 a.m., but she still manages to write nearly daily. As a mother of teens, I did inform her that 8 a.m. is hardly sleeping like a teen, but her dedication still leaves me in awe. In addition, I am absolutely convinced that in another life, Mary was a psychotherapist. As both a teacher and a writer, her insights into character are intuitive. I see shaking heads from her fiction workshop. Mary's stories resonate long after we finish reading them because her characters are quirky, complicated, and so very human. Mary is the author of 3 collections of short stories, Joe Baker is Dead, The Alibi Cafe and Other Stories, and Cookie Lily, the last 2 out just a year apart. 2 of her books have been nominated for Penn Faulkner Awards, and all 3 have been well and widely reviewed. Her stories and essays have been included in the anthologies American Fiction, In the Middle of the Middle West, and Under the Arch. Her work has appeared in many literary journals. She has won a Nelson Agron Award, and she has directed the MFA program since 1998, taking 2001 off to work on a novel. It is my special pleasure to introduce Mary, who has served as an important mentor for me. Thank you. I first want to say thank you to the library. This is just extraordinary. It's never open on Friday night. And a lot of people have volunteered to move chairs and tables and furniture, and it's just wonderful of them. I'm going to read from both of my books, but I'm going to do it all in about 9 minutes. I'm going to read the beginning of 3 stories so that maybe you'll want to read the rest of them. And the first one is from The Alibi Cafe, and it's the first 2 paragraphs of We're Still Keys. It can seem like nothing changes in Piedmont, Missouri, but I suppose things just happen too slowly to notice, like the extra lines that appear on a face, or the way details of conversations you swore you would never forget fade away. But Dad's still an on-again, off-again drunk, nearly as regular as the even and odd-numbered years. And Mom still has a deep-down itch, strong as it ever was, to have as many men as one lone woman can handle. The old drive-in's been reopened, running vintage James Dean and Marlon Brando movies, mainly for tourists who come to fish the Black River or Clearwater Lake, or to hunt, or just to escape from St. Louis and pretend they are getting close to the land and old-timey values. The town council members meet and eat at K&L next to the Phillips station, and not at the cafe Granny Keeney cooks at anymore because the mayor's nephew, who manages K&L, gives the town council discount. The drugstore is no longer a Rexall, and you can now order fax modems from the Sears catalog store. All the high school kids dress in baggy clothes now, but they still look like someone just shot their dog and they expected it, so they're not too bummed out. They are like us when we were in high school, but without the tight clothes. See, small changes. Kids are the same. We're still Keenies. Mom's vision is going fast, thanks to the histoplasmosis that showed up suddenly, even though she contracted it from gathering eggs in great-grandma Keeney's chicken house years ago. And now she gets tapes of books she never would have read anyway, like Grapes of Wrath and To Kill a Mockingbird. The Sonics added a burrito to its menu. Across from the Sonic, what used to be a sewing store and then a tax prep office is now an antique store for the new people who pretend to be small-town folk and live here less than half the time. Piedmont stopped fixing its curbs a while back, and now they're all crumbly with Queen Anne's lace shooting high up between the cracks by summer's end. The annual hot rod cruise from the drive-in to the Sonic and back again is bigger than ever for God knows what reason. And, oh yes, you can't cuss at the Blue Jeans factory anymore. Those are the first two paragraphs of We're Still Keeney. Now I'm going to move to Cookie Lily and read a little bit of the beginning of the second story in the book, The Most Beautiful Girl in the World. Aunt Peg entered the senior Ms. Oahu pageant, the first step toward taking the senior Ms. America crown, not only because she was beautiful, we all were beautiful, but also because she was a widow, and as her sister said, missed a husband's admiration. I was her trainer, not only because I was organized and savvy about beauty from my days as a fashion model, but also because Mom had tried that guilty stuff about familial responsibility and being self-absorbed on me. And though I did not take on the guilt she wanted me to, her talk made me angry enough to take on Aunt Peg and anyone else Mom wanted to foist upon me. Look who was calling whom self-absorbed anyway. How much more self-absorbed could you get than to divorce your husband and then build a concrete block and plywood box of a home 30 feet from your back door for him to live in, not realizing or caring that it would make your 11-year-old daughter the laughingstock of Prince Kuhio Middle School. Okay, I was no longer a cakey, and that was all old ground, the war cry of old battles. But I surprised myself by how close I had come to bringing it all back up. I was 32, already too mature for fashion modeling, yet apparently not far enough from adolescence. I did take exception to that familial responsibility line, though. Who stayed with you when you had your neck done, I asked Mom. Even as my marriage was breaking up, I did. And besides, we're all related anyway, at least according to DNA studies. The moke who steals my car is my brother. Where's his familial responsibility? Who stole your car? No one stole your car, she said. You're more Lolo than your father. Aunt Peg never stole your car. I gave her a fake smile, then gave up. I'd known all along I'd help Aunt Peg, my family, my cousin Bev in particular, but at our mother's urging, had taken care of me when yet another husband dumped me for no reason. Richard was my third husband, and sure, I could have decided I had a flaw or a hole in my aura, or maybe a curse put upon me by someone jealous of my beauty. I could have decided to give up on men and marriage and love, but even when Richard hit the road, I stayed optimistic. I've worn shoes that have given me blisters, yet I still buy shoes. I had hope. I believed the decision to go on was mine, and I could get over and survive any betrayals and rejection. I had to. I was beautiful and smart and would be successful. I said all that, yet when Richard left, ran off with our veterinarian's assistant, a woman with thick ankles and split ends, I grew afraid of the dark. And then finally, I'd like to just read the very beginning of a story in here called Luau, because it kind of sets up the whole Hawaii idea. Oh, by the way, in the previous story, keiki means children or child. And A moke is like a thug. Okay, luau. Sigisuda's new boyfriend, Fuzzy, did luau's. He worked the hotels mostly, planning and executing the expensive ones advertised as authentic, but was also available for private parties. Fuzzy was Sid's way of slumming, of living a degenerate life, of coming face to face with Sloth and maybe a few of the other seven deadlies. She had met Fuzzy through her after-school job, waitressing in the Royal Hawaiian Surf Room, and he laughed at her for studying chemistry. Such a good little Japanese, he said, nose almost worn away from grindstone. She knew he was right. Her relatives, especially her great-grandparents and grandparents who had worked the sugar plantations, thought it was good to work at waitressing just to pay for the privilege of working on a degree, just to get a good job, more work, later on. She thought so too, really, but at 22 wanted more than one further step toward the goal. And Fuzzy Kuhulehele was what her family called, just from the mention of his name, an oversexed, lazy Hawaiian. She did not have to tell them he drank his tequila straight from the bottle, that he sometimes made himself stupid with Maui Waui as he waited for the emu stones to heat up, or that he called in sick more than any other Royal Hawaiian employee. Her parents could not say his name without turning purple. And that technicolor display was followed by her grandparents' cold stare, which both chilled and pleased her. She knew they were her destiny, but she dreamed of the large black rose tattooed on Fuzzy's right forearm. And though he did not want to hear about electrons and neutrons, just the thought of tiny things spinning around made him want to barf, he said. He could give her chicken skin by parting her thick waist-length hair from behind and kissing her neck.